Hello everyone, it's Anthony DeMarzay here and welcome to Lights, Cities and Architecture. It's a podcast really around design and sustainability. So in a bit of a change of direction for the podcast, we're going to interview people who are associated with design and sustainability. And the reason for doing this is really in my work as an architect, you know, through the experience of working with clients, I've really learned that people want a lot of different things in their lives. And that sustainable outcomes is really just one thing on their list of needs and wants. And for me as an architect, I'm really committed to finding ways in which design can be used as a force for good and that we can take personal responsibility for the way we design and lived. So I think that there are many practitioners, and we're interviewing one today, Damien Wright, who work outside of the area of architecture, who share this belief and that we can do more with less and that we can design more and consume less. So to explore this idea, over the next six podcasts, I'll be talking to six different practitioners about this particular idea of decoupling design from consumption. So to introduce my guest, Damien Wright. Damien Wright is a craftsman, a designer, a maker of timber furniture. In addition to designing and making furniture on a commission basis, he creates sculptures and collaborates with other designers on various built projects. To quote Damien, primarily I get out of bed, I go to my workshop and I make furniture. It's a process of design and making, but I have a sort of lifelong battle of identity as to whether to call myself a designer or a maker. Increasingly, we are considering the source of the food we eat and the products we buy as a significant consideration in terms of sustainability. However, a lot of the timber that we're using in the design field is coming from the Northern Hemisphere, particularly Russia, and we also import a lot of timber from New Zealand. Knowing that Damien has a long-standing interest in design and in timber, I wanted to explore the idea of sustainability and design with him. Welcome, Damien.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So let's start. Let's ask some really basic questions. How do you see environmental impact and consumption when we're designing and making objects? What are some of the considerations that you give to that?
So it's a huge responsibility as a human being to try and deal with the consumption of your life. Like, what are you going to take from the planet during your lifespan? And we are all wrestling with that with various forms of awareness and various kind of capacity to self-examine. But as a maker in a material world where you're constantly in the process of dealing with making objects and investigating and dealing with materials, predominantly timber in my instance, you're constantly presented with the question about sustainability. Sustainability from the point of view of what are the values of this material? Where does it come from? What does it mean? What's the balance between using this material and an outcome? So as a maker, it's primary to that, to the craft practice, to be in a constant tension about the materials that you use. So how you come on out of that tension with a understanding of yourself as creating or being part of a sustainable practice or a sustainable world, I'm not sure. I kind of float in and out of it. Sometimes I look at what I do and think, you know, I'm a plaything of the rich. Mm-hmm. Who can afford handmade objects in an entirely industrialized, digitalized world. I'm an exotic, romantic, you know, cast off of the past, and that now has a commercial, social value, and it's, you know, it's utterly indulgent. It's got nothing to do with sustainability.
Well, let's just ponder that for a moment. You are very, very interested in timber, the sources of timber. So let's start with that really basic notion. So you do a lot of work with timber, and I know that, as I mentioned in the introduction, that a lot of the timber that we use in building in a variety of different fields comes from overseas, and you're sourcing really ancient timber that's been reclaimed and working with that timber. And I can't imagine how you do it, because it looks like it's stronger than steel, but somehow you manage to craft these objects into really beautiful and really fine objects. Can you talk just a little bit about the source of materials and how that came about?
So I've always been interested in where the timber comes from. And in an Australian context, I was really interested in the idea of using Australian timbers as part of a cultural realisation of the colonial society being able to reconcile its place on this continent. You know, that idea is sort of linked to a sort of economic botany argument about placemaking, which, as I've come to realise, which is entirely colonial, and I've been part of that. But that search has opened up all sorts of experiences and understandings for me about timber. So I've used desert timbers, I use eucalypts, and I'm essentially looking at timbers that are outside of a design canon, with the argument being that the design canon and craft canon comes from the Northern Hemisphere and is part of a cultural imposition.
Do you find that the use of that timber is in some ways a kind of reconciliation between the sort of European histories that we have and a local identity? Is it as simple as that?
No, nothing's as simple as that. So searching timbers led to this ancient red gum. And the ancient red gum is timber comes out of a mine. It's salvaged from a mining operation up in ancient riverbeds. In the briefest possible description, at the end of the last ice age, you have enormous floods into the what we now call the Murray-Darling Basin. They bury they flood trees, knock them over, bury them. Over the next 10 millennia, the continent dries. Those become dry riverbeds. The river shrinks to the Murray we now know. But we excavate and extract those ancient riverbeds for minerals. In this instance, it's gravel. And they come across these big trees. And the chemical process has changed that tree from red gum, to black. Mm-hmm. And so I then use that in furniture for a long process of how to dry it. It's very technical and very, very much a craft. Is it about reconciliation? Well, for me, it is at a certain level, with the idea that reconciliation is actually an existence that you have to live in all the time. Mm-hmm. What it's about for me is the complexity of being a colonist, mm-hmm. in a white Irish English descendant in a foreign land. And the black timber has opened up possibilities for me to work and collaborate cross-culturally and experience aspects of reconciliation that I would have never otherwise been able to do, because it's such a powerful symbol of the continent and deep time and culture. It's given me links to Aboriginal culture and Aboriginal people. And it's connected my work to an argument about place that's beyond our time.
I just want to pause for a moment and just say how remarkable it is that a person making chairs, making tables on a commission basis can find these kind of really deep links to culture, the sort of culture that exists here in Australia. Did you ever imagine that this was possible? Because, you know, it's like reading it's just like seeing through, you know, what is a fairly simple act, you know, craft act, actually creates these really strong connections that are embedded into the place that we live in. Can you just reflect a little bit on that? Because I personally find that very intriguing.
I mean, I think that's something that I was gifted by my, you know, my parents and the context that I grew up in. My parents sort of were always full of that sense of inquiry and connection, and they were very radical in their own way. And we did a lot of travelling and a lot of really interesting things that turned out, you know, when I look at my life now, it turned out to have been, you know, really unusual and opened myself and my siblings up to, you know, a view of Australia and the continent, the place and the materials that is the rest of the white continent is catching up to. So I guess I always saw it like that. You know, I always thought of materials as politics, essentially. Mm-hmm. And our house was a very political household. Mm-hmm. Everything was about politics, and everything was always understood within a conceptual framework of power, a conceptual framework of gender, a conceptual framework of race. It was not an easy place to grow up in.
I'm sure you had a happy childhood. It would be wrong of me not to talk a little bit about mass production. I mean, the sort of, you know, the IKEA of the world, and, you know, the way in which we can virtually get any piece of furniture delivered to our doorstep. Perhaps we have to assemble it, but, you know, the ability to get very cheap furniture to our doorstep, you know, that really has, I guess, no soul, no life, but just that change. I mean, I'm not sure if you, how familiar you are with William Morris, but I mean, that whole industrialization of craft and furniture was something that he really rallied against, because he saw it as taking away the human hand, the human heart, from the process of actually making that. That was well over 100 years ago, and it seems to have accelerated to the point of no return, such that the market is flooded with pieces of furniture, you know, goods and materials that we just can't imagine. Do you reflect on, you know, the world we live in, or is it that you have created a small little island for yourself?
Both those things, really. I do reflect on it, and that is my motivation. William Morris and Arts and Craft Movement Furniture, that's where I started. That was my first love, and that was partly because of the interesting politics of the movement, but also because my mother's family were publicans in Queensland, and all of the hotels that were part of her family were full of Silky Oak, you know, Arts and Craft Furniture. And so there's the Morris chair, and one of the first pieces of furniture I made was a Morris chair. And I loved that kind of the whole way that the particularly American Arts and Craft movement tried to commodify that through manuals and mail order and home construction. And there was a marrying of that form of consumerism to the idea that you would make it yourself. Mm-hmm. I do wonder about the world we live in. But to answer your question, I've made a bunker for myself, you know, and I've you know, worked really hard to do it, to create a place where I can still make beautiful things. But it is a strange world. I have no illusion about that. That, you know, I make one-off, handmade, using machines, you know, beautiful things that indulge the entire human experience, and that's in opposition to a world that has too many things.
From that sort of vantage point, do you have any advice? What do you perceive as being the way forward? Because what I've observed, or what I've recognised in your work, is that there's a really strong connection with the hand, the actual making of the object. Like, you haven't gone away and become an academic. You haven't gone away and written, you know, articles. You've stayed very true to your craft, and I know how difficult that is, because there's pressures on a whole range of things. You know, apart from anything, the human body doesn't keep functioning in the same way as it did when it was 20 years of age. But obviously, there's a kind of there must be a sort of stoic force in you to continue that road. Can you just explain what it means to you, I suppose, to be doing that?
It means everything. It's and I think that I can reflect on this through the pandemic as an example, that, you know, I was able to keep working because I can walk to my workshop. I didn't have to, you know, I just could keep working. I was really busy. I had commissions all the way through. And, you know, the craft, handmade craft, was a very sustainable and, a solid practice during a global, you know, a disaster. And for me, that's a sort of an example of the level of determination I've had to stay in that, but to stay in the making. And it comes from a deeply personal thing for me, and that actually is me. Mm-hmm. Like, I actually really, really like that process, and my projection on that is it's actually part of this there's a great deal of loss in modernity, that the human being, this is my, you know, woodworker theory, but the human being is a connection of your head and your heart and your hands and your gut, and we're this complex three-dimensional fluid organism. And what modernity has done is separated us off into the manual and the intellectual, and where what craft can do can actually bring all those things together. And, you know, it's really hard. Your body wears out. It's really hard to make a living out of all of those kind of things. But there's a moment, you know, there's a moment where when you're making, which is glorious.
Kind of nirvana for you.
You find that you're in tune, you find your sweet spot, the mixture between design, problem solving, and actually carrying out the choreography of the function to make something that's beautiful, that's going to last, that has beautiful respect to beautiful materials. It's, you know, people there are moments when you think you're the lucky one. Mm-hmm. You know, you really are the lucky one to be able to go to a workshop every day and do this. And there are other days when you go to the workshop and you think, hard, oh, my God.
We all have days like that, Damien. So I'd like to talk a little bit about your connection with Indigenous culture. I know that you've worked in North Australia, in Northern Australia with...
Porongo Yunupingu.
You've been working with him for 10...
More than 10.
10 years. Yeah. So it's a collaboration that you've been undertaking with him, and it just sounds... I've seen some of the work that you've done together and some of the ways in which you have worked together. And it's predicated on this idea of two-way learning, where there's a two-way exchange of ideas. The idea of reconciliation and the idea of working or understanding Indigenous culture is really critical, I think, to the whole sustainable journey, mainly because we have so much we can learn from Indigenous cultures, and the idea of being able to be happy with, dare I say it, with less, but, more connected to our environment, more connected to the place, more connected to people. These must be learnings that I suspect that you've gained from the discussions that you've had. Do you want to reflect a little bit on that?
Certainly. So more than 10 years ago, we moved to Arnhem Land, to northeast Arnhem Land, to a small community called Gunyangara, just near Yirrkala. And I helped set up a woodworking studio for the clan, the Yolngu clan, Gulmutch. And Bunula Yunupingu was the Yolngu mentor, Yolngu of the people. And he and I worked together in that workshop. And when we had to come home to Melbourne, Bunula started coming down to Melbourne and working for me, just to continue our connection. He lived with us. And we the way that the society works is kinship one. So we're already had a family bond between us. He'd adopted us into his family, and over the first few years of that, he just worked for me, and then we started collaborating. And the collaboration is called Bala Galili, which means all sorts of things, and I keep finding out it means more things, but as I have understood it, it essentially means learning from one another, two ways learning. It means balance, it means exchange. And what Bunula and I have sought to do is to build furniture and sculptural objects that reflect our different paths through life, but our connection to one another. It's been one of the most challenging and rewarding experiences of my life, and I think we have produced really beautiful and really unique and interesting work that's been shown most recently in the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, who have acquired our work, which will be public by the time this is public. And it's an ongoing project. It's an ongoing circular project. And to answer your question, yes, I've learnt so much. I've learnt so much about, from a technical point of view, but also about life. And the Yolngu view of the world, their understanding of difference, your understanding of connection and place is incredible. And just to reflect, just to make an example. So we talk about reconciliation all the time, and I've had this conversation with Bunula. Bunula's not all that interested in reconciliation, and, he says that's about us. It's for Balanda. Balanda are us, whether it's white people. Napaki means foreigner. We're Napaki Balanda, so we're white foreigners. And for him, he doesn't want... He's not seeking reconciliation. Like he has his culture. They've got to deal with us. They want justice, but they're not it was very, very clearly pointed out to me by the clan leader, Gullaroy Yunupingu, that Yolngu are not in deficit. And if you come up there as a white fella with the idea that you're somehow going to find yourself or save someone, or there's some cultural deficit of the Yolngu that you're going to fill, you will fail. Mm-hmm. This is only work by a two-way exchange. You can only learn by being a student. And it's a beautiful concept. And it's a beautiful concept for the country, because it's not necessarily trying to find a peace between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. It's trying to find a respect. And that it's asking white people to move their thinking, to stop trying to solve every problem, mm-hmm. to step across and stand with be part of a family, but you're not going to, you don't smother each other out, and that is reflected in our object.
How did it happen? Because you know you're very lucky, and I can see how it would have, how it fits very neatly into the sort of craft tradition, and how it fits into your ideas about seeing the country, seeing the environment. The invitation for you to work with the Indigenous sounds like a very generous offer to you, like that they were prepared to include you in their family.
Incredibly generous. And it came from the ancient red gum. And in the briefest explanation, a journalist, Gideon Haig, wrote an essay about my work, a long-form essay in The Monthly, mm-hmm. and Galarrwuy Yunupingu read that essay. And he literally turned up in my workshop one winter's day. My dad and I were there and working away, and Galarrwuy and his lawyer, Sean, turned up, and we had, I think this is the key to the entire thing, which is that my dad had his reading group the day before, and so he had this lovely lunch of fantastic cheeses and cured meats and beautiful bread, and Galarrwuy and Sean turned up, and we sat in front of the potbelly stove and had this wonderful lunch, which Galarrwuy was very, very into, and he said, come up. And so I went up and did a couple of weeks, and then he said, stay, and I said, well, I'll stay if my family can come up, and he just said, ma, which means yes, and I don't want to talk about it. He said, ma, munmuk, which is, well, munmuk, ma, means good, yes, and so then that was it, and we relocated up there. But yeah, it is incredibly generous, and Aboriginal people and Aboriginal communities anywhere, remote and otherwise, have to deal with us all the time, and it's both an immense privilege and an immense challenge to relocate and put yourself in that situation, and it changed our life as a family, mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see the ways and the depths that has changed our life. And, I worked, and then we worked really, really hard to make that happen. But I would go back again to my parents and their attitude to life. My mum and dad have always been involved in social justice and community, and they've had a lifelong commitment and fascination with it, and they gifted that to all of us.
Can you talk a little bit about the sort of the objects that you have made, because they're not traditional pieces of furniture either. They borderline sculpture. But they certainly belong to a craft tradition. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So, it's hard to describe for audio, but the first piece we made is called Wunakali, and that is two objects. The first object is a stick figure, mm-hmm. of stick sculpture of sort of man size of Bunala throwing a spear. And this is a really important object in our practice, our collaboration, because it was the moment in which Bunala could inhabit the collaboration and truly became part of it, rather than being an employee of it or a subject of it in a way. Like, the object is actually, he modelled it. He was throwing a spear in the workshop, and we were making stick figure models, and we said, right, that's it, we'll do that. And Bunala, so the first man is standing there, and it's out of the timber from his homeland, Gadeka, which is salvaged from the bauxite mine site. And then next to that man throwing a spear is another man, and that man is me, and that's a rectangular box out of ancient red gum. It's 6 feet tall, 400 millimetres square wide, and made with the thinnest veneer of ancient red gum, wired onto a frame using the copper wire technique that Bunala uses for securing bark paintings. And that ancient red gum is decaying, and it's all full of perforations and fissures from thousands and thousands of years of lying underground. And inside the box is a light. It's a fire, Gurta, and that's the symbol of unity. That's a cross-cultural notion. It's also a totem of the Gumatj clan. That piece is called the Black Lighthouse. So the first piece is Wunakali, and then the lighthouse is the Black Lighthouse. And so they're actually us. And the way the piece works is that they can be arranged in any way. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is a light. Yes, it is a sculpture. But mostly it's actually about two men, a Yolngu man and a settler man, trying to figure out how to live this life. Yep, moving together in all sorts of different configurations, never touching, but You know, like I don't want to be Yule. I can't and don't want to be.
Yeah.
And I also don't want to turn Boonella into a, you know, a modern industrial slave. Mm-hmm. So that's the first piece. Sorry, there's more of them.
There are more. Yeah. I've had the good fortune of buying two armchairs by you for a project of mine. These amazing armchairs that are really finely crafted, you know, using the timbers that you use. They are an armchair, but they are, you know, made predominantly out of timber with some black leather seating and pads. The owners really love it because they're really easy to get in and out of. So just the simple, just to bring it back to a kind of, you know, design, but just that process of actual design and manufacture is something that you must really work on, and really that craft tradition and getting all of the joints right, the sort of mechanics, the way in which the structure actually has to hold, you know, quite a heavy person at times, you know, gets moved around, gets kicked, and it has to, you know, survive, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. In the introduction, I talked about you not being sure whether you're a designer or a maker. Have you resolved that in your own mind? And do you just revel in the idea of what beauty there is in a chair?
I do. And I think the chair is a great way of thinking about that tension that I carry with me all the time, because a chair is a design object, and a chair is, there's no object that one makes or that one uses that lends itself more to industrialization than the chair. There's nothing, in every way it wants to be standardized in terms of the manufacturing of a wooden chair, modern machinery, computer cutting, all of those things. But there's no object in the canon that loses more by being industrialized. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you can't, that 50s chair comes out of it, 50s manufacturing or a modern chair. It doesn't mean it doesn't have a whole nother beauty, a whole nother conversation, but it's lost something. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that every handmade chair has that thing either. But there is something about it. There's something about the infinite variability. There's something about the hand and the thin proportions. And that is actually about that relationship between the design and the making. And the designing and the making is the craft. They're woven inside each other. And it is not pre-programmed. Mm-hmm. Every single piece is a response to every single piece. And this extends back to the chair argument, extends back to the whole argument about place. Because Australian timbers don't, in general, apart from very specific examples, they do not fit within the standardised European idea of timber. So they do not do very well in that manufacturing process. So our timbers themselves actually lend themselves to that thing. So for, as an example, in the curved arms of that chair we're talking about, there's a great deal of that machinery.
And I'll put some images up later.
Which is, you know, that's all can be done on a machine with jigs and whatnot, but because of the change in grain direction, because of the complexity of the timber, you know, it's all hand, it has to be done by hand. And that decision of holding the spoke shave and you're going one direction, you realise the grain's changed the other direction, and there's a melody in it, and you read it, and you know, it's a literacy. And that is part of the joy of it. And I think that when you make something like that, that knowledge and that craft, that hard-won craft, is passed on to the person who gets to use it and use it and use it. But it's, you know, it's so idiosyncratic and so individual that you could have all those skills to create that thing but not make something that can communicate what, you know, there's also intangibles in there. Like, how do you make a chair that has all of that same material knowledge but is as sexy as that chair? Like, it's a very sexy chair.
Well, it is, but...
You do have to have an eye somehow. In this design conversation, you actually have to somehow...
Figure it out.
Make something that looks good.
So you're obviously closely aligned with the making of the chair. I'll just talk a little bit about the experience of the owners who now own the chair, who are so happy with the chair, and it becomes a point of pride for them to talk about the story of the chair, who you are, that you're, fact, you know, you're only about 5 kilometres away from where they live, the timbers that you use, the way in which you work, and the whole story that comes with the chair. But equally, not just that when they sit in it, it's actually a very comfortable chair and they can actually enjoy the view, enjoy the space, and it sort of complements, you know, the architecture that's been created really well, so, you know, which has got a lot of timber, got a lot of light, and your furniture itself is similarly crafted. So it goes really beautifully. So the story of the chair has a life in manufacture, but it also has this life post-manufacture. I sort of want to kind of re-establish what the point of this podcast is. It's really essentially talking about design and consumption. It's really saying that as designers, we have a responsibility to think about how we can sort of decouple the work that we do as designers from consumption, that we are just making so much stuff out there. We can just buy any number of items at any given time. Like I could order in next to no time, you know, a new car, a flight overseas, a new Tesla if I wanted to, you know, a cabinet, you know, get an Airbnb. I could, you know, do a whole range of things. But the idea that design, or the idea that how we live our lives in this sort of modern world, seems to me we're on a pathway to some kind of destruction, because we're just taking far too many resources away from the planet to be sustainable. And particularly for us who live in, you know, wealthy, you know, wealthy economies like Australia, like Melbourne, we have a responsibility to actually think about ways in which we can design more and consume less, that we can actually use fewer resources, but the resources that we use should have value. Because I think, for instance, if we were to buy one of your chairs, the idea is that you would retain it for much, much longer, that you would value it, that you would actually care for it, that it actually has that story that so many other objects. And there are a lot of very expensive chairs out there. It's not a question about cost necessarily, because there are a lot of expensive chairs, but the story that goes behind the making of the chair actually becomes one of the reasons that we want to retain it for much, much longer.
Mm. Well, I think this comes to what I would like to talk about in this argument about sustainability, is about cultural sustainability. I have an understanding of the politics and the environmental and other of forestry, timber industry, and I make decisions around that with the resources that I use. But essentially, I think that what we're talking about is a cultural deficit, that we actually have, we've overstepped, you know, we've created an offside trap for ourselves with our capacity to consume that far outweighs our capacity to moderate what we actually need. And this is incredibly difficult, because how do you do that? Mm. How do you actually say no to anyone for anything when we've gotten rid of all of the, thank God, or maybe not God, but thanks, we've gotten rid of the grand narratives that put us in our lanes, told us where we'd be and how we had to accept this and that from in every way. And so how can you tell people they can't consume? Like how, and at the same time that happens, you have the ultimate delivery device in your palm where you can do all those things. You could buy your car or get a dozen shares, bang, hit a button. Mm. There's no restrictions on any of it. And yet somehow we have to restrict ourselves because of the apocalypse. Mm. You know, the only thing that's stopping us from just plundering the planet is the idea that it's all dying, which is essentially a double negative. And we've just gifted that to our kids. They're angry and righteous, which is not a great combination. Mm-hmm. They're angry, righteous and addicted to exactly the same things that they're angry and righteous about. Consumption. I don't know where the politics of design draws itself away from mass consumption, glamour and fashion, and turns itself into an argument about cultural sustainability as well as material sustainability.
So what you're saying, in a sense, is that whilst it's an interesting notion, it's not perhaps very realistic that we are addicted to consumption, whether we like it or not, and the only thing that is kind of restraining us is the potential for there to be, as you call it, an apocalypse at some point in the future.
Yep.
And there are real contradictions, aren't there, in the way we live our lives, and that we aspire to be sustainable, but through our actions we very often aren't. We'll travel overseas, we'll buy expensive cars, and we'll do a whole range of things that are contradictory to that sort of way of life. So, you know, I guess it is a bit doom and gloom when you look at it in that way, but what I have observed through my own research, through talking to people and people like yourself, is that there are people out there who are actually trying to find a different way forward, like the idea of designing a chair, the idea of creating a meal that is comes from the, you know, from a close proximity, the way in which people are actually really thinking about how much energy a house is consuming to be able to support a family. I mean, these are really important discussions, and designers are really central to that because they're the people who are initiating that conversation. So the conversation that you're having about what a chair is or where the material comes from, they are real decisions that you're making. And I suspect, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, they're being made on the basis of a good use of material, a sustainable use of material. And there are a whole lot of other things like, you know, cultural, political and other stuff which come into it. But also I would imagine, please correct me if I'm wrong, you wouldn't be choosing a timber from a non-sustainable source. You'd be trying to find materials that, in a sense, aren't plundering the planet, not coming from Northern Europe and travelling all those miles, thinking more locally, thinking more about how it is connected to place, and that sort of feeds into the story of design and making.
I agree. And you can't just throw up your hands and say, it's all too hard, I'm going to go and, you know, live on the side of the mountain, although that's kind of what I've done with the craft practice. And I agree with you. And but as much as I can make those decisions about what timber I use for what project and how they connect to an environmental sustainability, again, it's a cultural sustainability. And yes, design has a really important role to play it. And it is happening, and there are bits and pieces, and you have to start somewhere. But that's why I'm here, because I agree with you. I think design actually has to find a way of talking about itself that is really politically effective. And to do that, it not only has to decouple from the politics of consumption, mm-hmm. and it has to set itself up as an authority figure on sustainable material, the world. And to do that, if it's constantly seduced by being an authority figure on fashion, or, you know, what's hip and cool and, you know, and new and whatever it is, at the moment, that's what it does. Mm-hmm. That's what people get trained to do. And this other side of it is a minor bit player in the argument. And the argument about sustainability is filled up by a whole lot of other people. There's a whole lot of other professions that fit into that. And, you know, design and particularly craft don't really have a voice in that.
Mm, you know, I agree
don't,
with you
we
that.
Don't have a voice. We don't, like, even though we're deeply involved in the sustainable use of materials and sustaining a culture from a craft point of view that has been under attack for generations. I mean, we've survived the Industrial Revolution. We've survived the design revolution. They gave us away, you know, and now the design community want us back. Like,
you mean craft?
They want craft back, yeah. You know, designers figured out that it's soulless. It has no soul, and they want us back because, you know, we've got one. And that's fine, good, that's awesome, we're back. But it's, you know, design actually at some point has to take a political responsibility for what it is beyond the kind of bespoke and niche thing that I do. So it's cute what I can do, and I can say all these things from the side of a mountain, but actually somewhere in it, someone has to make some decisions to, you know, from the ethics of it, stop stealing other people's designs. Mm. That would make us more sustainable. Stop, you know, plundering the planet.
Before we started the podcast, we both went on a bit of a rant about Teslas. So
you want to hear my Tesla rant?
Well,
buckle up, kids.
Because in the abstract, when you're talking about design culture, and I'll paraphrase, I'll put my slant on it, there is this kind of notion that, you know, we've exchanged some people have exchanged the Ford Ranger, which is not the symbol of sustainability, for a Tesla, and is that the way forward? So there is this kind of green, like, you know, is a Tesla more sustainable than a Ford Ranger? I guess it depends on how you look at it. Is it that we are moving in the right direction, that more and more people view a Tesla as the more sustainable option? But there is this view that where we think that we can purchase our way out, consume our way out of this problem by choosing eco-friendly products, which may be a small step in the right direction, but really doesn't do what we need it to do. I mean, I haven't seen anyone sort of cancelling overseas trips because of sustainability concerns. I haven't seen too many people exchange their cars for a bike. So they tend to want to replace like for like. So, you know, the Ford Ranger has to become a Tesla, or, you know, the dishwashing liquid has to become the eco-friendly dishwashing liquid. So that's, you know, the T-shirt becomes an organic T-shirt rather than... So I think the reason, one of the big reasons for talking to you is because it seems to me that on some level, the idea of consumption is really reduced down to a number of objects that fill your life with greater joy, and the sustainability is born out of not just the fact that it's good for the planet, but that it's less likely that you're going to have to throw it out in 6 months' time or 2 months' time, which is a real issue. You and I both live in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, and every day there is a TV on the sidewalk, on the footpath, sorry, or as was recently the case, a massive photocopier that in its day would have been, you know, close to $10,000, and was just tipped over on the front nature strip. And I thought, my God, what is happening to the planet? So perhaps to conclude, I'm now going to allow you to go on your rant, Mr. Wright.
Oh, no, don't give me that. We'll be here all night. No, I agree with you. I think that there is much to despair about. But, you know, I was having this conversation with our youngest child last night that, you know, there is much to despair about. Life is, in politics, is about power. Capitalism produces a notion and promotes a notion of two things. That one is that the natural order of the world is competitive, and two, that the competitive dynamic is meritocratic, that the cream rises to the top. And we are in a moment of reckoning culturally, where we're, even conservatives are having to recognise Marxist structuralism. The Liberal Party is having to accept that the reason why women are not in their party is because of the structural inequalities of our society. Mm-hmm. There's change. Mm-hmm. It's changing. And if that fundamental dynamic of competitive market capitalism has to look at itself, and conservatism that protects it has to look at itself seriously enough to reinvent itself around a structural analysis of society, there's hope. And the same for the design and consumption dynamic. It's because it is, doesn't have to be what it is. To use Marx twice, we make the world. It is made, and we will make our future. And this is a battle. It's a battle for designers. It's the battle for designers to drag themselves out of fashion and drag themselves into politics and say they are the supply chain authorities, and that primary to that logic is environmental and social sustainability. And if they can, you know, if they can get off the marching powder and get serious about their politics, it'll happen.
I think the idea that because it was the way it was, I'll paraphrase, doesn't have to be the way it will be.
Everything is made.
Everything is made. I think that's a really good place to end our conversation on. And just thank you very much for coming in on a Friday. It's a very hot day here in Melbourne, so we've had a few glasses of water, and really commend all of you to sort of have a look at Damien's work and see what he actually produces. So,
but thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So, with that, we'll say goodnight. Thank you.